Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Final rules have kicked in for companies selling software to the government. They must now attest to the fact that they used secure development practices. Their reference has to be the Secure Software Development Framework from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Here with what really has to happen, the Chief Technology Officer of Legit Security, Joe Nicastro. Mr. Nicastro, good to have you with us.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on, Tom.
And you are advising agencies on how to handle this rule. So let's begin with the contractor side, though. What do they have to do now, and for what types of products must they do it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So largely with the SolarWinds attacks that happened, there was an executive order that came out essentially saying that, you know, NIST was going to create a new guideline or framework around software supply chain security, which ended up becoming the NIST SSDF. And then very shortly after that, you know, CISA decided to utilize that SSDF as part of an attestation for them for companies that are selling software to the overall government. This was in commenting period, but as of last week, it was finalized, which essentially means that within the next 3 months, all critical software that's being sold to the government needs to have this attestation done. All non-critical software that's being sold to the government needs to have this attestation done within 6 months. And essentially what this attestation is a form that is being signed off by either the CEO or some other designated C-level person within that organization, or a third-party authorized regulator that's going to come in and essentially say, hey, these particular controls that are in place properly, and we're attesting to CISA that this company is following by appropriate standards and practices for their software development.
If you're a Microsoft or a SaaS or a Salesforce or Oracle or any of these giants that pretty much dominate the software industry, don't they already use secure development practices? I mean, not that there's never a vulnerability, but do they have anything to fear if they make this attestation?
I think most organizations have a lot of the controls that are being asked for by SSDF in place, right? Things like having the appropriate application security tooling, whether that's static analysis, dynamic analysis, you know, software composition analysis, et cetera. I think where, you know, most of the organizations are going to struggle putting in some of these additional controls is largely going to be around the overall supply chain itself. There's a lot of tools on the market right now that primarily focus on the risk within an application. Not a lot of tools out there that are focusing on the risk in the actual software factory that's creating this code. And I think that's the reason why we've seen a lot of software supply chain attacks increase over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, sometimes upwards of 600-700% year over year, right? So I definitely think that larger companies have the capability of meeting these controls. I think they obviously have a little bit more work to do, but definitely something that I think that they'll be able to get done. I think the bigger struggle for especially large companies is going to be attesting to this in an automated way. I think one of the things that's lacking in this new CISA attestation is the ability for organizations like Microsoft or these large organizations to attest in an automated fashion. Right now, it's largely PDF driven or filling out a form on a website. And when we're doing things at the speed of development, any manual processes like this are going to slow that down. And I think that's going to be the biggest hurdle for organizations as we move forward.
And just backing up the food chain for a moment, the reality of most commercial software is that there's a little bit of coding by the vendor, and mostly they've assembled open source components that might be common to 10,000 other programs. So is that going to be an impediment to being able to safely make an attestation?
So I think, again, a lot of the organizations that we're talking about have some form of testing with regards to software composition analysis to make sure that the open source packages that they're bringing in are healthy and don't have a lot of risk to them. But yeah, definitely going to be a concern as we move forward is making sure that, again, the packages that we're using aren't introducing additional risk into that organization. I think the bigger picture, though, is looking at how that open source and those packages are being utilized in the application as a whole within the organization to really start looking at risk holistically, as opposed to just determining whether or not there's a vulnerability in a package that maybe not an active code, maybe not touched by the overall, you know, code that's being used, you know, maybe not even have a reachable vulnerability, et cetera.
We're speaking with Joe Nicastro. He's field CTO of Legit Security. And a final question on the vendor side, what are the consequences if they make this attestation and then some vulnerability is exposed? Because I don't think their software has been published yet where somebody can't hack something. So what happens then?
I think this is something that we're all waiting to kind of see. I think there's definitely been some precedent set with the Uber CISO, you know, going to jail and the SEC suing the CISO for SolarWinds. So I definitely think that there's some precedence there for there to be an ownership or an onus on the overall leader of the security programs at these companies. I don't think that there's a very real threat out there of what's going to happen should you attest to something like that and have, you know, a breach or something that's shown that maybe you attested to something improperly. But again, I do think that we're starting to see a shift in the way that, you know, we're looking at these from a legal standpoint, where there is going to be some level of personal responsibility being held by either the CTO, the CISO, or somebody else who's signing these overall attestations, saying that, you know, if there is a breach, there's going to be consequences.
Well, hopefully they'll get minimum security. And moving over to the government side, what do contracting officers, is that the point of enforcement of this? What are you telling them they need to do now to make sure they get the right documentation in of the attestation?
If we're talking about from the government standpoint, like CISA and what, you know, I think they need to adjust in order to make this a little bit easier for organizations, largely, like we talked about, some form of way of automating these overall attestations into the government. Again, if we're talking about organizations that have one or two applications, you know, filling out a PDF is not a large lift. But when you're talking about organizations that have upwards of 100, 1,000, even 10,000 applications that they're selling to the overall government, running through 10,000 manual PDF to sign each attestation becomes a very large lift. And at that point, you're slowing down the development process to the point where, again, it's something that most organizations are really going to think about whether or not this is something that's important for them to do. I think if CISA could come out with some form of way of automating these forms, whether allowing for, you know, an API ingestion or something like that, it definitely allows organizations to start to pin these attestations directly into their overall development processes so that they can start to attest to these things as development is happening with all of the controls that they already have in place.
Both sides then really need the grease, if you will, of an automated process that is nevertheless tied to something that legitimately happened.
100%, right? I mean, the whole goal of all of the security that we put in place with development is that the security moves at the pace of development, right? Our goal is never to slow down that development process, largely because, again, this is typically how businesses are making money. It's how they're creating feature sets. It's how they're keeping relevant in their overall spaces. So if we slow that down, there's other risk or ramifications that affect the overall business, right? So our goal as security should always be to implement these practices or controls in a way that's really invisible or transparent to the overall development process. And I think the same thing with the CISA attestation, right? Being able to grease, in your words, both sides so that we can attest to these things in a way that's reasonable, as well as that's, you know, giving the information that the government needs to show that these controls are in place, is going to be very important to this entire program being successful.
And what about resellers that really do move a lot of the software? Are they just third-party pass-throughs and the attestation is still belongs to the vendor?
Yeah. So at that point, I mean, I think what we're going to see with a lot of the resellers is they're going to be, you know, spinning up services that will essentially do the attestation for them, right? No different than what we see with like third parties that are doing a lot of the FedRAMP attestations for that side, where it's now become a service. I think we'll see the same thing with the CISA attestations, where organizations will start to come out and basically sell those services to organizations and say, hey, we'll validate your controls. We'll, you know, make sure that everything you're doing is according to the overall CISA attestation requirements. And then we'll sign off on it for you.
That could be a new value-added profitable service.
Yes, 100%. I definitely, like I said, I definitely see that something is going to pick up with a bunch of the resellers and different types of compliance agencies out there. Again, we see it with things like FedRAMP already. We see it with SOC 2 and all of the other compliances out there. A lot of these compliances are really hard to meet, right? And so if you can have a third party come in and give you an understanding of where you have those gaps and fixing those gaps, it makes it substantially easier.
Yeah, I can see the new We Have Attested socks being given out at all the trade shows.
I like it. I like it. That's one of my favorite things about the trade shows is all the fun socks that are out there. I'm definitely down for some CISA attestation socks.
Joe Nicastro is Field Chief Technology Officer of Legit Security. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate you having me on.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era, to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm gonna go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I wanna hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.